Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. It's Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and welcome to another episode of Be Unique's Unscripted, where we talk to artists, musicians, performers, and business professionals. My name is Tony Taylor. I'll be your host for this evening. You know, you could spend your Thursday nights anywhere, and we are excited you're spending it with us. The conversation is cool, it's calm, and it's casual. You can also be a part of the conversation by dialing 516-418-5651. Now, before we begin, let's talk about why you need to get on your phone and go to beunique.org. That's B-U-N-E-K-E.org. Here's what Be Unique is all about. Our mission is to work today to change tomorrow using digital mediums to connect the world with professional storytelling and media production. We work to educate, inspire, and foster positivity and creativity worldwide through video, audio, and a spectacular literary magazine featuring writers from around the world. The newest Be Unique magazine is out right now, and you can read it online along with Be Unique Brevard magazine, the Space Coast premiere magazine. Be Unique is also a media powerhouse. Not only do you get this incredible podcast hosted by me, Tony Taylor, but 11 other shows. So sit back, get comfortable, and get ready to dial 516-418-5651 with your questions, comments, and whatever else you may want to say. Let's meet our guest.
All right. Good evening, everybody. It is Thursday night. It is 9 o'clock. It is 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, and you are listening to Be Unique Radio and Be Unique's Unscripted. My name is Tony Taylor. I'll be hosting tonight. Tonight, I am honored and I'm privileged to have Professor Amy J. Keeley on. She is an award-winning marketer, CEO, and professor whose information-packed workshops, seminars, and masterclasses have provided and helped entrepreneurs and business professionals expand their identify areas of growth. She holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in English from the University of Michigan, a Master in Business Administration, and a Master of Education. And she attended an international study program at Cambridge University in the United Kingdom. Amy's mother was also the first female engineer at General Motors, and her father was a successful entrepreneur. Amy ran concession stands starting at 8 years old, and she shares her 20-plus years of business experience and educational experiences by teaching college courses and participating in business workshops in the following disciplines: management, business law, marketing, human resources, English, communications, photography, and in a fashion merchandising program. She is also able to inspire and motivate people personally and professionally by helping them see their value. Amy's master classes are full of case studies and activities to help people learn by doing, not learn in theory only. It is her students that stay in touch that give her the confidence that she's making a difference. Professor Keeley, welcome to the show. I hope I got everything right.
You did. Thank you, Tony. It sounds much worse when people say it out loud.
Okay, great. Well, I want to welcome you to the show, and I also want to just let you know that you're one of our first guests to discuss the economy and global news that we're talking about tonight. With so many subjects that you are a master of and so many different talents that you have, I wanted to focus on one thing in particular, and that is the Great Resignation. And can we start off right off the bat by describing or defining what exactly is the Great Resignation?
I think that's a great question. I think the Great Resignation is what corporate has coined this term because they are struggling to keep people working for them. And so they're seeing a higher turnover in their workforce. And in replacing those workers has become a great challenge for them. And they are still struggling to understand why people are resigning from working in the workforce. Yeah. And I think that in some cases they are on the right track for why certain people are doing it. But I think that they've missed, in a way, some of the massive changes and how it impacts them, in particular how people are being trained in the educational system and then what they're doing when they come out of school.
Right. And as an interdisciplinarian with, you know, workforce management study for 20 years as such, you've narrowed it down to, I guess, six factors. And let's talk about the first factor, which you say is voluntary mandatory overtime.
Yes. The first time I heard that term was with my mother when she worked at General Motors.
Right.
And probably in the 1980s, she came home and said that, you know, she was going to have to do voluntary mandatory overtime, which was when General Motors and other large – yeah, which is, okay, so 40 hours a week plus 10,
right.
And we're not going to pay you for the 10.
Right.
So I never saw my mom. She was always gone. And,
wow.
You know, it was one of those things as I started to think about kind of that voluntary mandatory overtime and what it meant – is I started to think about the fact that what companies needed is workers to work longer hours with the same pay as 40 hours a week. And
right.
I even caught myself doing that where I'm paid 40 hours a week, but I'm putting in 90 to 100 hours a week.
Sure.
And that becomes a challenge, right? Unless you're really efficient at your job, it's a struggle to keep up
yes.
with that workload or the expectation that employers have of you. And in part because they're now competing in this global marketplace. And there's always the discussion of whether, you know, corporate greed and that's out there. And I struggle with that because I'm an independent voter and thinker. So what happens is that I can see both sides. So I can
right.
see, yes, CEOs in some cases make too much money, and yet they also are legally responsible for their companies. So they take on the burden legally. If they don't run the company correctly, there's huge ramifications. And they're also losing time with their family because they're
sure.
always working too. And people, I think, sometimes glamorize what the CEO does, where I tend to focus is that, so according to the Small Business Administration, there are 33 million businesses in the United States in particular. There are, of those, 19,561 of those are actually large corporations.
Wow.
The rest of the 33 million are actually small businesses, and about 70% are one owner. So consultants, people that are running their own little small mom-and-pop shops, but the rest of them are sort of mid-sized companies because the Small Business Administration also kind of adds to the ambiguity because they'll say, well, we define a small business as 500 employees. Well, to me, that's a mid-sized company. So
right.
what happens, on, especially on those mid-sized companies, is where in order to get to that billion-dollar mark of what they want to do, they have to work harder, and so do their employees.
Sure.
And that's where a lot of that voluntary mandatory overtime comes in. And I started thinking about it because when I was doing sales, I would, when a customer was late to a webinar or to a conference call or to a meeting, I'd always say, oh, don't worry about it. We're all doing the job of about 15 people. And I thought about it. I'm like, wait a minute. We are doing the job
yeah.
of 15 people.
Right.
Because if you think back to, like, let's say what used to be a secretary. My mom was a secretary. It was get coffee, take dictation, plan schedules, maybe do a little bit of the events that they're doing. And that's predominantly what their role was. Now they're admin assistants, and they're
right.
doing scheduling, they're doing marketing, they're doing finances, you know, doing expense reports,
right.
Even writing checks in some occasions, being security chiefs, I've heard, where they're actually
mm-hmm.
having to do security checks on people. So they're doing a lot more HR. So that role I started thinking about, I'm like, wow, they are doing the job of 15
yes.
people.
Yes.
And so you have the voluntary mandatory overtime of now I'm working more hours, less time with my family, and I'm having to do more. I'm now discontented, and I don't know why. And that's where I think that mandatory voluntary overtime really burned people out.
Good, yes. I can relate. In my former job, there were two people running in my department, and the one person got a promotion to operations manager, which left me as a department of one. Now,
mm-hmm.
we handled a huge convention center here in Orlando, Florida. We also, you know, not only dealt with the shows coming into the convention center, but also all of the in-house folks. And I found myself
you know, doing now a double duty on every job that we were, you know, because we had split up, you know, responsibilities in the department, but now I was doing double duty, and of course there was no mention of any kind of compensation given for that, and it was very frustrating, and I found myself very depressed because I felt devalued.
Right, and you were, and so I actually had that moment, I think it was a couple years ago, when I'm like, wait a minute, I just did 90 hours this week. That means that anything over 40 hours, I'm now making less money. So
right.
Instead of looking at a six-figure salary, I'm like, okay, so I'm actually not, I'm barely hanging on to six figures at this point because
right.
the work I'm putting in. So if you took a normal, let's say, a $50,000 salary, and you're putting in all this mandatory, you know, voluntary overtime, you're probably only making about $30,000 if you start
right.
to take away all those extra hours that you've worked.
Right.
So we have people that are struggling in the workforce to keep up with what their employers expect of them. And then you have people who are not organized, and again, that's where the stress, the anxiety, bosses yelling at
sure.
you, why isn't this done? You
sure.
also have some people that are super efficient at their job. So a friend of mine she just retired from General Motors, and she was working at a plant here in Michigan, and she got upset with her boss because he didn't really understand what she was doing nor wanted to, and would see her with some downtime and then complaining about why she had downtime. Well, she got so sick of it, she ended up leaving and going into another plant. It took them four people to replace her.
Oh, man.
Four people. That's how efficient she was at her job. But because she was devalued, because, you know, that's a manager's job, right, is to look at your job and say, are
right.
you performing it properly? So,
right.
my, like, for example, my philosophy is I'm a micromanager or a macromanager. If you figured out how to hit the goals I want you to hit, God bless.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care when you come in. I don't care when you leave. You know, and that's the Google philosophy of focusing on productivity. But if you're not, then it's my job to micromanage you to get you where that needs to be. And now
right.
what we have are all these people, these managers that are micromanaging people to 60, 70, 80 hours a week because they know
right.
they have to push them to keep working.
Right. And
that adds
to
the overall stress.
And also, too, I mean, doesn't the fact that most of these folks are on salary and they're looking at the time they're spending and they're looking at their paychecks going, you know, gee, I'm making this amount of money at this amount of time. And it's very,
mm-hmm.
very, 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 very frustrating.
It is. And
disheartening. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It is. No, it is. It is absolutely. And I mean, like looking at my mom, I rarely saw my mom. She would leave at 5:30 in the morning and get home at 6:30 at night.
Wow.
So there's a lot of people that are like that or having to work two jobs to bring in an income. And that's kind of the American way. I mean, we are hard workers and that's what employers
right.
know.
Right.
But it's okay if it's occasional, I think. Sometimes there are
yeah.
big projects that require a little
sure.
extra work, but what the workforce has become to expect is that it's something that you give 365 days a year. And that's why I think it's leading to this great resignation, is where people are just like, you know, it's just not worth it for me. You have the older generations that are, listen, I'm on the downward slide of life,
right.
and I would rather retire and go be with my
right.
grandkids or my family
right.
or travel the world. I don't need this anymore. So you see a lot of companies like Allstate, which will bring their retirees back, but they bring them back because they say basically, well, you can work the hours that you want to work, but you know so much about, let's say, catastrophic claims that we need your knowledge, but we just give you flexible hours. And they'll accept that because they can
yeah.
still make money, but on terms. But most of them just like, I'm done. I'm cooked. I can't do this anymore. And they just walk out. And that's part of that great resignation, is they just can't do it anymore. And they would rather spend the rest of their lives, you know, doing what they love to do.
Right. And that gets us to your second factor, which is COVID. What did COVID, you know, as horrible as it was, did COVID expose those inequalities? Did COVID bring about, you know, putting the time, the effort, and the expectations of bosses on employees into light?
Yes. in many different ways. So, for example, the Department of Justice is still trying to unpack, and I looked into it because I know a former boss of mine probably took some things that he shouldn't have. So what they, when I talked to the Department of Justice, is that basically what they said is they knew that they needed to get money to employers quickly, so they didn't put a lot of parameters around it. And that's why you're still hearing about a lot of COVID money theft, the PPP program,
right,
where employers right. were taking this money and then not trickling it down to their workers, which was the intent of the program, which was
right.
you're going to lay off people here. We're going to give you money so that you don't lay those people off. And that you, if you have to go and pay for your utilities and whatever, then it keeps those people working, keeps the lights on. What we
sure.
now found is that they pocketed that money, millions.
Oh, no.
And, oh, yeah, millions. And you're still hearing about the Department of Justice prosecuting people. In my industry, which is the workforce management industry, it's more complex, but the theft was probably greater because many staffing companies have payroll line of credit with most banks. So, for example, General Motors, Walmart, those companies have 120-day payment terms, so which means that you don't have money coming in for 120 days, which is like 6 months. So you can
mm-hmm.
go get a loan, a line of credit, and then that line of credit is such that now I can pay these workers based on a line of credit, knowing that I will get money from, let's say,
right.
Walmart in. Well,
right.
what has happened is a lot of this PPP loan money was slipped into the lines of credit, so you can't track it. It looks like the normal payroll that's coming in, so you can't track, because normally it would be, here's the money coming from the government for the PPP. It would have come in as an ACH, and it would have been dispersed to payroll.
Mm-hmm.
So now they hide it in these lines of credit. So it's been, especially in the staffing industry, it was harder because these people were working hard. And
right.
like many companies I heard, it's like, oh, we're going to have to, my former company, and other companies too. Well, you know what? We need to have our workers take a 20% pay cut, because if we're all going to make it through this, we need to all chip in and donate our money.
Do our part, right.
So many of them were saying, okay, I'm going to take money away from you. I'm not going to pay it back to you because no one knows that I got a PPP loan, and I'm also going to ask you to work harder. And even if I don't ask you to work harder, you're going to want to work harder because you're hearing about all these layoffs and you're wondering if
right.
you're next.
Right.
So I'm now going to work harder to try to save my job. And so what they get is, now I don't have to pay my workers 20% less than what I normally would. I've just pocketed this big PPP loan,
wow.
and my workers are working even harder than ever before to save their jobs.
God,
so
sounds like
all of that plus the...
I was going to say, it sounds like out and out greed.
Oh, without a doubt. You give them an opportunity. And not everyone was bad like that. Many, many employers did use it for the right things. But
okay.
there are many of them out there that did take advantage of it. And the hard part is, so you add the pressure of just what was going on in the workplace, of having to work harder, move
mm-hmm.
your office to home, having to balance out screaming kids, dogs, cats, whatever, trying to find that, you know, reorient yourself. But then you had the pressure of misinformation and all of that, that even now we're starting to unpack some of that. So, for example, I wasn't as stressed because I knew I had SARS in 2005, and
right.
that's the parent to COVID.
Right.
So I kept telling my friends, I can't get it. Like, logic alone, I can't get it. And
right.
now the University of Washington, along with, in conjunction with the National Institute of Medicine, are doing studies on old blood with SARS. SARS hit our country in 2005. They're doing
mm-hmm.
studies, and the studies show that the old blood contains proteins that block COVID.
Oh,
which is
okay.
why I sat next to people who
right,
had COVID.
Right,
I
right.
can't get it because I got the mother of all the vaccinations that you could possibly get. So you have this people now threatened by, okay, well, if you don't get vaccines, then you don't have your job. And now what's good vaccines, bad vaccines, misinformation. You know, you've got politics that then gets involved with it, with Trump saying we're going to close the borders, and Pelosi in Chinatown saying, oh, come on down, you don't need to wear a mask, and then that flips, and everybody's stressed. So then you look at this, like, this just pressure cooker that now you're already, you know, mandatory voluntary overtime.
Sure.
On steroids because of COVID, with all these pressures going on. And I mean, for example, another one that I gave my cousin, who's an RN, I had watched on the BBC, there's a doctor who said that there's a breathing technique that they were using that helped alleviate symptoms of COVID. And it's basically you breathe in and out 6 times heavily, and then you cough into your shirt, and you go lay down on your stomach for an hour breathing in and out. Now, why do you do that? Part of why you lay on your stomach for an hour is you are deactivating your diaphragm so that when you're breathing, the air is going into your lungs where it needs it, those oxygen. And the other thing that we were doing that was odd is that we were having all these COVID patients in the hospital, right, laying in bed, suffering, whatever. Well, your lungs are on your back.
Right.
So if you're laying in bed all day, you would not get a solid deep breath in.
Right.
So all this misinformation out there and people panicking made COVID this really kind of toxic cosmic time where people were already just starting to become disenfranchised with the longer work hours.
Right.
And that, I think, came from the fact that the older generation, I'd say like the boomers, there's still a few silent generation. That's the kind of like my dad, the 80s, you know, like Warren Buffett is a silent generation and still working in his 80s. And then the older millennials, they were more prepared to handle COVID because the way they were brought up was, like, I was laughing the other day. I said, like, for example, like, we had Pong and Texas Instruments, because I'll totally date myself.
I remember Pong.
Pong, yep, Tetris, you know, Centipede, all that kind of stuff.
I remember that,
So we had the beginning of modern technology, but we spent more time playing. But if you remember putting a mixtape together, you had to listen to the radio with your finger on the button, waiting for it to happen. And then if the DJ talks, and you're like, shit, got to start all over again. We sort of grew up waiting. So we go into COVID like a little bit more prepared with the coping skills of waiting, you know, holding back our emotions, being able to like problem solve things out. Whereas the younger generation, like the millennials and the Zoomers, and that's part of what we'll get into later about the education, is that they've not been taught those coping skills that we have. So while it was stressful for all generations, there are certain generations that coped with it a little bit better. And I think that the only reason why the boomers really stressed about it was that one of the things I think that they'll unpack in the future is the fact that, and I'll say it, but it's not like it's obvious, which is we're not a healthy nation. And now what happens is that when somebody has, for example, high cholesterol, what do? They give you a medication and you think, oh, I'm cured. No, you're not. You just have medicine that masks your disease or your illness. Well, I think that COVID kind of got under that. Like, it knows you're unhealthy, and it attacked people who were unhealthy, which is why you heard that people were obese, that were dying of COVID. And again, they were broadcasting these news stories, panicking people. And, you know, when you have that kind of death, or even if they're inflated numbers, it still looks bad. Like, most people don't realize that an average of 100,000 people die every year from the normal flu.
Right.
And with COVID, it was only, I think, 150,000, maybe 180,000 that died.
Right.
Now, death is bad, but it wasn't in those big numbers that they were putting out. Or I've heard of people that, especially here in Michigan, because we were on full lockdown.
We were.
I know of several people actually that were in car accidents that could not get into the hospital because they didn't have COVID. So they were not allowed treatment. So they gave them COVID on paper so that they could admit and treat them. So we'll find out years from now, not only were there other solutions, but there were also inflated numbers because people were moving. And I don't necessarily blame people because it was a turbulent time.
It
and people
was.
Were just trying to grapple. But I think in terms of, like, the Great Resignation, you're at your home. People are, you know, you heard of the Salvation Army actually stopped their donations after for a while because people were cleaning out their houses and
right.
donating so much,
right,
redoing
right, right.
their backyards.
That's right.
That's why there was a rush on, like, landscaping companies. And, you know, here, you know, you could go to Ace Hardware, but you couldn't go to Walmart to buy landscaping. But people were at home. And it's like now I think what happened and set in with COVID is like, wait a minute. If you're going to ask me to work all these crazy hours, then I'm going to work from home. At least
right.
be in the comfort of my own home with my family, my dogs, and, right. and then I'll work these crazy hours. And maybe not so crazy hours, but because I want my quality of life. But that's the pivot I think you saw with COVID and the resignation is people just saying, wait a minute, no, no.
Right, there was a
it's
realization.
Just, I need time out.
There was a realization
yeah.
at that point. Exactly. Now, you
yeah.
also talk about another factor, which was the educational failures.
Mm-hmm.
What do we mean by
yeah.
by that, by educational failures?
Meaning, for example, school was always designed to be a feeder pool for what I call supply chain corporations, meaning that anybody that's making a product or a service that we consume. And so, like, books that we read, printers that we buy, fans that we might buy, heaters, anything that you would buy as a consumer, that's part of the supply chain. And what has happened is that business, I guess, I want to say, fell asleep at the switch and didn't
okay.
realize that there were changes that were happening in the younger generation. And schools, in a way, have become now for-profit corporations because they're no longer listening to corporate about what they want. I mean, they still listen to them a little bit. Like, we want STEM workers. Okay, we'll give you STEM workers. But what they did is they took out home economics and shop class, and now you have people that don't have practical learning skills. They've learned in theory, science, technology, engineering, and math.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened is that you now see the rise in colleges of entrepreneurial programs. Well, what is an entrepreneurial program? And trust me, I'm teaching at a college right now that has an entrepreneurial program, and
okay.
it's designed to teach students to open and run their own businesses. So if you have these large schools across the nation teaching the younger generation how to be entrepreneurs, how are they going to come out and work for a company?
Right.
They don't want to work for a company.
Right.
What they've done is they've heard their parents, exactly, what they've done is they've heard their parents say, God, I hate going to work. My boss is a pastor. I don't want to work
yeah.
there anymore. And what do you think they did? They're like, okay, I'm not going to work in the corporate world. I'm
right.
going to run my own
right.
company, and I'll be a 1099 contractor. And then that's got its own problems because they don't really understand how to minimize their financial exposure, and they also don't know what working for these large corporations means. It means a hefty insurance policy to be able to work for them.
Sure.
So there's these failures that happened in the education system so that now you have people that don't even – so that's really also where that great resignation came in. When they say, I want to be an entrepreneur, they're resigning from going in and working
company.
In the corporate supply chain.
Right. Right. They're not working for companies. They're trying to work for themselves.
Exactly. And it was funny. Yeah. I was at a speaking event, and somebody I had this young kid that was taking my pictures, and I didn't come prepared to have – they said they were going to have someone take pictures. And so I got this guy to video me, and I said, oh, no, he's going to work on his own. He doesn't want to work in the corporate world. And the lady was standing next to me. She looked at me, and she goes, is that true? And he went, yeah. Now, mind you, I didn't know this kid. Did not know him, but I know he didn't want to work in corporate. And I had, she's like, you were right. I'm like, because they don't want to work in corporate. So that's also part of this great resignation is that they want to own their own companies. And that also, you know, creates a problem for corporate. You know, they don't understand that you almost have to work in corporate as sort of an apprenticeship. You know, if you think about apprenticeships in the past, if I wanted to be the blacksmith, you would work with the blacksmith for your entire life, learning all their skills, all their nuances, and then they would die and you'd become the blacksmith.
Right.
They don't want to work in corporate. So they're, in a way, doomed to make those mistakes and learn because they learned it in theory. No one could possibly prepare them for what entrepreneurship is. So it's a bit of a challenge for them.
Now, you also talk about, speaking of education, you talk about entitlement. And you talk about parents being over-engaged with the school. Do you want to explain more about that? I mean, what we're talking about with entitlement and...
Sure. I guess the best example I could give you was when I was teaching... I had a gentleman approach me about wanting to write a book about millennials, and he was asking me for my feedback. So I'm not just a marketer. When I'm teaching, they're my little focus groups. So, but a lot of, I'd be surprised that a lot of my colleagues don't look at it that way. They go and they teach the class, and I'm just interested enough to watch what they do. So he took me to lunch to discuss like what his intention was. I'm not just going to let anybody into my classroom, and I had to find out it was more of an investigation about what he wanted. And we were talking, and he said something like, and I said, well, I don't have children. I said, my brother used to always say, oh, Amy, you can never understand the role of a parent because you're not a parent. I'm like, no, I watch, and because I'm not a parent, I can see that you are blinded by love. You are not seeing the realities of what you're doing with your children. And it gave me this different perspective. So when I was talking to him, he's like, oh, yeah, my son's coming, home from high school and, whatever, whatever. And I was making him a sandwich. And I was like, oh, excuse me, wait, you were making him a sandwich? And he's like, yeah, I'm making him a sandwich. I said, well, my mom and dad would say, Amy, your hands aren't broken. You can go make your own sandwich. Yep. And he looked at me dumbfounded. He was like, exactly. And he looked at me dumbfounded. He goes, I am doing it, aren't I? I said, yeah, you are.
Exactly.
So all those little things that parents do for their children, in a way out of love, or when they make the claim of, I'm going to raise my children, they never have the experience that I have. I'm writing a book about my mom, about her experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah, about her experiences, because there's a lot of sexism that she went through.
Well,
what I learned about it.
And I've seen that picture. It's unfortunately, we don't have it up right now, but I've seen that picture of your mom there sitting at the table with all... Mm-hmm. being the only female there. And I can imagine the pressure that she felt and was under at that point, especially at that time.
I did a lecture at a women's group I was a guest speaking keynote speaker at a women's conference in Chicago. And my mom was going through Alzheimer's. So it was so emotional for me. And I'm in a PhD program because I'm completely stupid. So, and now I've learned I know nothing. I was grappling with her being in the final stages. So I've learned in my PhD program to write scripts because that's what they do in that world, and it's different than the business world. So I wrote a script because there's no way I could have said what I had to say without crying. But what it is like, so my book is like, the first book, half of it is really about my mom, like all the experiences that she went through. But then also the second half is like the lessons I learned from her.
Sure.
So, for example, the one thing I shared in the book was in that picture you saw, my mom was wearing a skirt.
Right.
And that picture was taken while she was still a secretary. And so she was working for the plant manager who managed several plants. And she had asked him if she could, after she finished her work, if she could go measure with the engineers. And I found out why my mom did that, which was an interesting part of the book that I didn't expect. But what I found out is that, so for example, she had petitioned HR if she could wear pants, because now she's on the floor walking this massive... I know people understand that in Flint, Michigan, the Buick facility was a 5-mile square radius complex.
Sure.
But so she asked HR if she could wear pants, and they said no. And so the only reason why they changed their mind is they found out that men were standing underneath the industrial stairs, you know, that they're open stairs looking
boy.
Up for syrup.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my
now,
word.
With that said, her boss was not going to give her an engineering title, and it was those same men that really stood up to him and made him give it to her.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
So she taught me things like that, like how to be able to work with men and not be so offended by certain things and be focused on my job. But she has a lot of great stories like that. Or like I think one was my dad told me was that she would walk up and down the industrial line. And my mom was an incredibly beautiful woman. They would throw nuts and bolts at her to try to get her attention. So
your
so
mom's
I
walking out of the plant going, I just got pummeled. I got pummeled by nuts and bolts.
Exactly, with bruises on her.
I'm trying to walk
the
plant, and I'm getting bruised. I'm getting bruised
exactly.
up because of the nuts and bolts that are flying out at me. Oh, that is funny.
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, that is
so
a wonderful
when I
story.
Say... you. Yeah, I mean, I learned these all as I was writing an article about her, and then I've decided to branch it out into this story of this mother-daughter relationship that was very complex but very loving in a way. But when I say entitlement, my mother never gave me anything. I had to work for everything. So when I got grounded, I would put my toes right at the end of my purple carpet, and I knew if I could get her talking to me that I could get out of my room, but I would go right up to the carpet because I wouldn't go over because I was grounded in my room. But what I learned from that
Keeley,
is that
that's
I
actually very brilliant.
My purple carpet. But what
that
I realized
very
is that
brilliant.
She,
no, that is
what she was doing is that I was building really strong business cases to try to get out of my room.
Right.
And I
carried
that forward into my career. So those are the kind of stories that I was writing. But when I say entitlement, thank you. When I was talking about entitlement, is that a lot of people would have said, like in my case, well, I'm never going to raise my children like that. Well, any time you decide to raise your children any different than how you were raised, you will not ever know. You'll never be able to relate to them. Because they have a different set of experiences than you have. And I'm talking about on a small level. So the definition of chaos, and I don't even call it the chaos theory. I call it the chaos principle now because we all see we have chaos.
Right.
And the Egyptians, for example, were terrified. They actually have a god of chaos. That's how much they were fearful of chaos. So chaos, the definition, is small, minute changes on a complex system. So what are children? But complex systems.
Complex
and that
system,
small, minute just, that one small, minute change is tiny. All it has to be is I'm not going to discipline my child, or I'm going to step in and call the school because my child got bullied. When we went to school, it was, okay, here's how you handle it. So your parents were teaching you the coping skills for how to be able to manage
instead
situations.
Of stepping in. Yeah.
Right now, when I say entitled, is parents are stepping in and doing things for their children. They do their homework for them now. They go to school and beg them. I literally have had a 22-year-old that worked for me whose dad came into my store because I had a vintage resale shop, high-end designer. But her dad came into the store to chastise me for something. I'm like, excuse me, get out of my store. Your daughter is 22 years old.
Okay.
And if she's got something to say, but that's what I mean when I say entitled. So you now have this younger group of generation that doesn't have the same coping skills. So when they're under pressure at work, and I guess the best way to give you an example is I called U of M, like after the Hillary Trump presidential campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not here to talk about politics, but what University of Michigan did was to establish safe rooms, and they had Play-Doh that they used to help keep them less from being stressed and help cope with their anxiety and whatever. Right. And I emailed the president and the Board of Regents, and I said, congratulations, as an alumni, I will never hire another U of M grad again because you've now just created HR nightmares. I said, so when I when they have their first performance review and it goes negatively, what am I supposed to have, Play-Doh in a safe room?
Here's your can. Go enjoy.
Exactly. Like, let's do a kumbaya moment before we actually give you your performance review. So when I say entitled, they're not taught the coping skills, and then they go into the corporate world in some cases, and they can't handle the pressure, the same pressure that the older generations have become accustomed to. They don't like it, but they've learned to handle it. This younger generation, I literally had an employee OD on an anti-anxiety medication because we were putting out RFPs, and he just couldn't handle it. I mean, it was hard for me.
Sure.
So that's what I mean about entitlement.
And you know what? You really and I want to thank you on a personal note because I have a daughter, and she is 23, and you know we made her, or we shouldn't say make, we had her face her troubles herself to try to figure them out herself.
Mm-hmm.
We purposely, and I get that. My mom and dad were depression kids, so they were of that generation, and that's the way I was brought up, was that, well, here's the problem. You need to deal with it, you know, and don't expect me to be able to step in because we won't always be there. You know,
exactly.
And it really, I can see the transformation in her and how she's doing, and she's doing quite well. I really feel, you know, wow, that's a really positive reinforcement of parenting skills because you're really not doing them any favors.
None. Any parent that goes in and tries to coddle their children.
Right.
I did some research at a preschool that I'm going to be writing about, and I had one parent that brought a 16-month-old and asked me to cube up his blueberries. And I was thinking,
are you kidding?
He's not even developmentally up with his peers.
Oh my God.
So what I did, as soon as she left, I gave him blueberries and I gave him animal crackers. And he ate them without choking.
Amazing. Isn't that amazing how that works?
It is. And so I had to say, oh, well, you know, his classmates were the ones who taught him how to eat, you know, and so I didn't out myself of just giving it to him. But so you have those parents that are like, the one thing I can't stand, and I know this is going to sound horrible, kiddos. Don't call them kiddos. You are raising people who are adults, and kiddos are a certain point, like elementary school, maybe. But when you get to about sixth grade, you are now a mini adult that you are being trained for the workforce.
Yes.
And I saw an interview with somebody from Germany who says that I don't understand how Americans raise their kids. They're keeping them to be children far longer.
Yeah.
And so what do you expect? You're training them at the most critical time to be children. You're not training them to be adults. And so when we see the entitlement is they don't know how to work hard. And that's why I don't blame them. And I've never blamed. In fact, I've had millennials and Zoomers come up to me, the Gen Z, come up to me after speaking engagement and say, thank you. Most people come in here and just bash my generation. I'm like, no, it's not your fault.
No.
But we have to get you up to speed as quickly as we can. Otherwise, we all fail.
Right.
So
it really, exactly what you're saying. We all fail.
Right. So when I say the entitlement is part of that great resignation, when they get, and trust me, they've been taught by education to do a great resume, to present themselves very well, to ask for the manager role. But when they get into that role, that's why you see the job flipping, because the minute they have to perform, they can't.
There.
They don't have the experience. They don't have the knowledge. So what do? They leave. And then they go find another better job. And then the pressure builds up. Then they leave. And I know millennials, some of them, that have 40 jobs on their resume.
I work with a person right now who has had 30 jobs.
Wow.
30 jobs.
And this is what I don't understand, because it used to be the thought was the first year, understand your job. The second year, you're perfecting your job. The third year, you're positioning yourself for your next job. And it's either your company sees your value and they promote you or you leave.
Right, right.
But now I had a student.
No, go ahead, Professor Kaylee. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, I was going to say I had a student one time that told me that she, I went to go ask her, I'm like, so how'd you like your new job? And this was like 8 months later after she took my class. She goes, oh, no, I left that job. Her mother is the vice president of HR at a large utility. Goodness. Like, are you not telling your, and she walked into my class with a Louis Vuitton handbag, like a $5,000 you know, Louis Vuitton handbag.
Unbelievable. You know, I was in a, this is about 3 years ago, I was interviewing for a job, and I was actually asked by the HR person, wow, you were at this job for 18 years. Why?
I know.
You know, maybe it's, you know, because of the way I was raised, but I was thinking to myself, well, isn't that a good thing? I mean, that means
yeah.
I was doing my job. That means that I was performing all the duties I was supposed to do. I was getting there on time. I wasn't calling in sick all the time. I was doing my job. And it just, the question just kind of floored me.
Because they're so used
absolutely. To seeing jobs. We're running out. Well, we could talk for. We're running out of time. I wanted to really touch base with you on the last two factors, which was a disruptive social media.
Yes.
What were you talking about with that?
Kind of going back to that younger generation. What people don't like, Mr. Beast. I don't know, he's the largest YouTuber in the world. It's 56
right.
million a year, and he's 25 years old.
Wow.
So the answer is that social media that has now become monetized, or Etsy or eBay, a lot
right.
of them are saying, I don't want to work in corporate. I'll just go vintage shopping. That's why now you can hard-press to find vintage in like Goodwill and whatnot, because they're flipping them online faster than ever.
Oh, I know.
So social media, and they're not really even considering that when they're looking at the workforce. So like the Bureau of Labor Statistics was predicting in 2022 that there would be a workforce reduction because the older generation is starting to retire.
Right.
What happened in 2022 is actually this where we are in what they call the Great Recession. Well, part of it is because the older millennials are leaving. But they haven't factored in the fact that many millennials and Zoomers, again, are using social media to monetize it. So I know I did this math. There's a couple of websites out there that if you say I want to make $200,000 a year, they'll tell you exactly how many views and subscribers per social media channel that you would have to get to earn $20,000 or $200,000 per social media channel, which totals to $600,000. So you've got this younger generation that have figured out I can just go, you know, go travel and just vlog myself and get interest and do a TEDx talk and then parlay that with 100,000, you know, Instagram subscribers into
right.
a really nice career.
Sure.
And so they don't wow. have to work in corporate at that point.
Wow. In our
but nobody's
last
really looking at that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you what, you're seeing a lot of it, though. Seeing a lot of it,
yep.
and I guess that's where we get the term influencer, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
Your last factor, we're running out of time, and I apologize, Professor Keeley. We have governmental
okay.
workforce tampering.
Yep. So,
so
if you think back to NAFTA around that time frame, the decision was made of poor general labor workers. We're gonna upscale you and teach you how to work in the IT industry so that you can make more money. And we're gonna shift all those low-paying jobs over to China and places like that so that you
right.
don't have to work on those nasty jobs. Well, now, right now, on the globe, the country with the highest growing and fastest growing middle class is China.
China.
Because what we forgot about is what made America and what made our middle class was our manufacturing plants,
right.
the general labor, the blue-collar worker. So now all those jobs are shipped overseas. So now they've taken and they've moved people into nursing. They've moved them in particularly IT. What just happened?
Right.
the government could never see because they don't understand business. None of the lawyers or political science majors that are working in our government have ever worked in business. What they could never know was that technology was heading towards AI, which means all of those workers with chat APT and new things like that, it's replacing their jobs.
It is.
So now all those people that you trained for those higher jobs have no jobs because the technology has replaced them.
That's
what I meant about the workforce tampering. They got in, thought they were doing something good without really understanding the ramifications of what they've done, and now they've put us in a pickle. So.
Well, Professor Keeley, we could talk longer, and I apologize, but we are running out of time. I want to definitely, if you could please let us know where people could reach you or learn more about you.
Sure. So I have two websites. One is Education Success Strategies. It's basically my YouTube channel and my website. The website is edusuccesses.com. And then also ProfessorKeeley.com is another place that you can go and find more information about me.
That is fantastic. And I would like to ask a request before we leave. When you do publish the book on your mom, would you mind coming back on the show and talking? Because I would love to hear more stories about your mom and the influence she had on your life and just all of her experiences being in the situation she was in. I know that must have been a lot of pressure, and it must have been a lot of stress on her. But it's amazing, you know, just a story about the nuts and bolts. I mean, that is just a an incredible story, and it's very interesting to me. And we love talking to authors, and I would hope that you would come back and join us again.
I would love
and
to.
When you get that book. And I really, really, really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. It's been an education. And I wish you nothing but the best, and I hope to talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Tony. I appreciate all your time and you know, just the great questions. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Professor Keeley. Have a great night. That's about it for us, folks. This is another episode of Be Unique's Unscripted. We were with Professor Keeley. And join us again next Thursday at 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time for another exciting episode. Thanks again, Professor Keeley. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. You too.